Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue, the emerging role of Cereblon E3 ligase modulators, or as we now call them, CELMoDs, in the management of multiple myeloma. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Natalie Callender from the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center in Madison, Wisconsin, where I think it's a little bit chilly today. Also, I'm guessing a little bit chilly is Dr. Paul Richardson from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. And today we're going to be talking about CELMoDs. I actually met with Dr. Richardson about a week ago for a parallel program. We're doing more and more micro-learning. You'll see a lot of programs coming out with short-form videos. And so I recorded that with Paul, a little bit different type of format, but also gave me a little bit of insight to help prepare for this experience tonight, which I'm really looking forward to. As with all of our programs, and actually the two major products we're talking about here today are not currently approved, but we'll be talking about unapproved agents and regimens, so check out package inserts of various products for more information. Here's where we're heading. We're going to talk about how CELMoDs work, what we know in terms of efficacy data, a little bit about extramedullary disease, adverse effects, and particularly what's happening and what will be happening. But, you know, just to take a breath before we get started here, I want to say that, you know, when I met with Paul last week, we had a very interesting discussion, and I learned something about a new trial that I can't wait to talk about. We're going to get into it later, very relevant here. But, you know, just mentioning it, we're going to have this program we have every year for general medical oncologists, and people are always thinking, wow, how do these people come up to date? But, you know, it's also really exciting to be in all parts of oncology and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the trial that Paul was talking about, I started to think about what are some of the favorite trials that we discuss in our programs that we enjoy talking about the most. And there's so many of them. I love the EMBARK study in prostate cancer that showed oral anti-androgen actually more effective than the treatment we've been using the last 25 years, LHRH agonist, although the combination was better. You can see the list, you know, the VIALE-A trial looking at HMA venetoclax, really changing the role of the community-based oncologist in the setting of AML. SOLO-1 study, the first time we really saw a positive trial looking at PARP inhibitors and cancer in general, and particularly here in BRCA-positive ovarian cancer. The ADORA study, adjuvant targeted therapy of lung cancer. Just last week at the GI ASCO meeting, guess what? There's a new first-line therapy for HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancer. Zanidatamab chemo plus an IO, tislelizumab. We saw the ATOMIC trial last summer looking at IOs and MSI-high disease. I mean, it goes on and on. ESMO, we saw cell-free DNA being used in an adjuvant trial of bladder cancer. The LIDERA study, one of the most historic paper in breast cancer, just presented in San Antonio, maybe going to change adjuvant endocrine therapy. And, you know, same thing in heme cancers. AMPLIFY, looking at, you know, BTK venetoclax, acalabrutinib. The ZUMA-7 study, looking at CAR-T and then bispecifics. New drugs in CML, ITP, a new combination there, as well as desmoid tumors. The Triangle study, looking at mantle cell. But here's the one I've always loved, and I've been talking about it ever since Paul presented it a few years ago at the ASCO meeting, the determination study. And what really fascinated me was he told me about D2, as he calls it, determination 2. We'll get later into the details about the exact structure of it. What really fascinated me and what made it so relevant here, obviously, Paul, is that the induction regimen is isatuximab, and as well as the CELMoD iberdomide, as well as isa iber VD. And as induction, we'll get later on into the issue about where transplant fits in, of course. But Paul, can you just kind of summarize the bottom line of why you all decided to use ESA, first of all, as an induction, as well as IBER instead of lenalidomide? And we'll get more into that as we go along.
Well, thank you so much, Neil. Thank you for all you do, first and foremost. It's incredible, actually, and so helpful to everybody. I think from the point of view of determination, too, we're building off, obviously, what we learned from D1, that one size does not sort of fit all, and that transplant can reasonably be held in reserve for a proportion of patients, recognizing it remains a standard of care. But very importantly, with IBA-VD-IZA, we've got a quadruplet that we think will actually take a next step up from the current platforms of KRD-DARA, KRD-IZA, RVD-IZA, RVD-DARA, and why? Because IBA, of course, is the backbone, and you asked a critical question, why IZA? Well, to be fair, we were really impressed that isatuximab seems to engage high-risk myeloma, and in particular, the 1Q portion of patients who have this specific abnormality in the genetics of their myeloma amplified. And it may be, whilst clearly daratumumab does work in 1Q amplified disease, there may be an edge for isatuximab built on a mechanistic consideration. And there are other aspects of high risk where isatuximab may also have some benefit. But really, our goal was, how could we build on the established value of the quadruplets? Would isatuximab perform well with this particular platform? And one key point to remember, Neil, as to why we choose it, is because you dose it weekly in the first month, and then you move to Q2 weekly. Iberdomide combined with DARA requires DARA to be dosed weekly for 2 months. And what we found from that study, led actually by Shaji Kumar and his team at Mayo, is there's a lot of myelosuppression because of the weekly DARA for 2 months with the IBA. Interestingly enough, in pivotal work led by Enrique Osio in Spain, the combination of IBA, VD, IZA did not do that to the same extent. So there's both practical and high-risk considerations that we felt led us to use isatuximab in this setting. And we've also had a great experience with isatuximab, recognizing that we've also had a super experience with DARA. So with all of those nuances in mind, we landed on IBA, VD, IZA.
So, Natalie, any comments? I know you were telling me you were involved with some of the trials with IBA, and obviously now also in the maintenance setting here in the Determination 2 trial. Any thoughts about how this is going to play out in terms of tolerability compared to lenalidomide?
Well, I think one of the things that the trials using iberdomide seem to show pretty consistently is that there is some myelosuppression. And I think we're all learning that lower doses seem to be quite effective. I think the best thing about CELMoDs in general is their ability to be combined with, you know, virtually almost anything that you can think about. They seem to be useful in enhancing the activity of all sorts of different types of approaches in myeloma. So I think this study is potentially going to be game changing.
So there's so much more we're going to talk about later, particularly as people have been hearing for 2 years based on my conversations with Paul Corsi. This is one of the few phase three trials that was able to recruit a considerable number of African-American people. And we actually saw some interesting things and differences in that population. A couple of years ago, we were hypothesizing about Duffy Null as maybe the factor. And there was just a presentation that Paul and his group did at ASH that we're going to talk about later that gets into that. But it's a little bit off topic, but so interesting, I wanted to bring it up. So we'll get back to that later. This is going to be one of the most fascinating trials, I think, of all in oncology. All right, let's talk a little bit about how CELMoDs actually work, and particularly compared to the IMiDs. Paul, can you kind of provide a brief overview and, you know, not so much describe these, for all these slides, you know, we just show for people to check out afterwards. You know, we're here, probably two-thirds of the people are listening in their cars or working out right now. So if you're walking down the hall, you're walking down or raking the leaves or maybe shoveling snow where you guys are. But if you're walking down the hall making rounds, Paul, and you don't have any diagrams, how do you describe your vision about how these agents work and why they're different than IMiDs?
Thank you, Neil. Well, several E3 ligase modulators are distinct from IMiDs. They're all sort of part of a broader family of degraders or molecular glues. But at the same time, their ability to engage the key pocket in the cerebral E3 ligase complex is everything. And basically, how you can think about this is that the immunomodulators engage that pocket to some extent and close the complex by about 10 to 20%. In contrast, the cerebral E3 ligase modulators are bigger molecules that close the whole pocket down, and by doing that, shut it down between 50 and 100%, 50% for Iber, 100% for mezigdomide. When you do that, it's like hitting the Death Star in Star Wars, right? You get right into the center of it, and by doing that, you targeted degradation of Ikaros and Aiolos is maximized, and that not only kills the plasma, the malignant plasma cell, but it also sends into overdrive the immune system. And so, as we love to say, mezigdomide is sort of CAR T in a pill. I mean, obviously, we're being very tongue-in-cheek with that statement. But the fact of the matter is that these are potent activators of the immune system, as well as getting right into the core of the Death Star and shutting down that core complex around cerebral E3 ligase that seems to matter so much to myeloma pathobiology.
And Natalie, we were talking before, and you brought up the issue. I don't know if it's called, they're called cereblon degraders, but now we have BTK degraders, we have estrogen receptor degraders. What about these? What about cereblon?
Yeah,
is it called a degrader, cereblon degrader?
So there are these degraders. Cemsidomide is one that is under investigation, and these are going to potentially degrade Ikaros and Aiolos directly without even working with cereblon. But I think one of the most amazing things about these CELMoD drugs, in terms of how well they bind and allow for ubiquitization, they can do so even at very small levels. So you need a whole lot more of lenalidomide and pomalidomide to do this. And I think your lab at Dana-Farber has looked at this, that very small amounts of these drugs can do the same thing, meaning you could probably have less toxicity for a patient.
You're absolutely right, so, Natalie. But I apologize, Neil. I was just going to say, Natalie's absolutely right. The whole point is that pound for pound, there's so much more potent. And so the off-target effects are going to be likely less, which is an excellent point, Natalie.
What about, you mentioned this CAR T in a pill idea, but what about the immune effects? I think you were telling me that like deaths during the pandemic seemed to be less when you had patients on CELMoDs compared to lenalidomide. And also the issue of not just immunologic, but also in terms of second cancers, Paul. What's your vision for the mechanism of development of second cancer with the IMiDs, and why do you not see it, apparently, with the CELMoDs?
Well, I think it's important to remember lenalidomide uniquely has an off-target effect on C1K alpha, which basically clonally selects P53 mutated cells of a variety of stripes. And when that happens, obviously, your second cancer risk magnifies, and in particular, when you combine it with other mutagenic agents such as melphalan. That is not the case with iberdomide or mezigdomide. And my own colleague, Dr. Adam Sperling, has really investigated this, and it's very clear that the CELMoDs do not do this. Lenalidomide uniquely does. So this is a big value add potentially to the CELMoD.
And what about, again, the issue of the pandemic deaths and the sort of immune effect on T cells?
It's a good point. I think the difference here actually, Neil, is actually this, that we enrolled during the height of the pandemic to our mezigdomide DEX trial, and we actually had no COVID deaths in a multi-center international trial. We got plenty of COVID, but no actual mortality. The reason that's so important is bispecifics in the same time frame, amazing as they are, obviously they generate a degree of immunocompromise or repressed immunity to a much greater and broader degree. As a result of that, they also, of course, activate the endothelium with CRS. And COVID-19, as you know, loves that endotheliopathy. It's kind of caviar to it. So when you put that together, say for teclistamab, for example, in the pivotal trial that was otherwise so amazing, they still had almost 30 deaths from COVID. In a similar population of patients at the same time, we had zero. So I think in the context of the pandemic, it had a clear advantage from an infectious death point of view. How that translates into practice today, of course, remains to be seen. But Natalie, I think it's fair to say that we don't see the same infection profile that we do with CELMoDs that we do with perhaps antibodies broadly and CAR T in particular.
I would agree with that completely. And, you know, I think bispecifics are turning. I think we still don't have the best solutions for preventing infections yet in bispecifics. But clearly the CELMoDs enhance T cell function, which is, you know, one of the best aspects of them, I think.
Natalie, what about, you know, enhancing immune therapy? We've seen, I still don't exactly understand how BTK inhibitors affect T cells, but I've seen trials where BTK, like ibrutinib, is added on to CAR T. What about using CELMoDs or BTK? What's the difference in terms of how they affect immune function, and would they theoretically enhance immune-based therapy like CAR T or bispecific?
Well, I think that, you know, I think you're going to see presented very shortly. There are a lot of these trials underway where people are using cell mods post CAR T for the purpose of trying to boost that T cell response and maybe make the CAR Ts more functional. I think you can do a lot of neat in vitro work where you're showing that certain subsets of T cells are upregulated, some of the effector T cells, for example. And I think how to exploit these the best in combination with T cell redirecting therapy, I think we're going to see tons of that in the next couple of years.
I 100% agree. Sorry, Neil. Yeah, I was just going to say I 100% agree with Natalie, Neil. Yeah.
No, I was going to say that every time we talk about myeloma, I feel like I have to do like a tasting menu because every topic you get into, like you can just talk about all day long. But anyhow, let's try to at least get through some of this or hopefully all of it. And we tried to kind of, you know, there's obviously a lot of slides out there, a lot of trials out there. Mm-hmm. Paul goes through a lot of the details and the sort of microlearning thing we did. Mm-hmm. But Paul, maybe you can just sort of summarize in general what we've seen with CELMoDs. Here are some of the trials that have looked at both of these agents, both iberdomide as well as mezigdomide. But you kind of summarize the bottom line globally of what we've seen in terms of efficacy, specifically with these two compounds, Paul.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Neil. So what we've seen is the remarkable synergy, and Natalie touched on it earlier, the ability to combine easily both iberdomide and mezigdomide as excellent dance partners with established backbone agents, be they carfilzomib, bortezomib, and even actually other novel drugs as well as antibodies. For example, you can very reasonably partner mezigdomide, for example, with daratumumab, and similarly iberdomide with daratumumab. So, and there's even data with elotuzumab. And Natalie touched on this. The bispecific data is looking very promising, and there's really nice work for maintenance strategies with iber. Mezigdomide partners very well with pretty much everything that you put it together with. Mm-hmm. There's even work with mezigdomide and selinexor, led by my colleague Dr. Clifton Moe. Remarkably active, even in the most fragile and most immune-exhausted patients. So lots of opportunity, I think.
I just want to add, in terms of the study that you just went through, Magnetism 30, I was very pleased to see that the addition of to elranatamab did not cause any increase in infections.
Good point.
That was very reassuring that strategy is going to work. And it may be, to that point, there was no grade 3 infections at all in Magnetism 30, which was very striking, I thought.
Yeah, it's an excellent point.
Is the thinking, Natalie, is the thinking that, again, kind of getting back to the immune effect of this, that maybe some of the benefit is actually enhancing the activity of the bispecific?
That would be a lovely thought. That was a very small study. It was only a number, I think, like 24 patients, but certainly very intriguing.
Yeah, and I would go further, if I may, Neil, and say that the point is that by combining with a CELMoD, the intensity of therapy that you require for the bispecific is not
less,
the same.
Yeah.
So you can avoid that downside of the cell of the bispecific, because you can have less frequent dosing of your T cell engager and use the oral agent to make up for that in terms of anti myeloma effect.
So I guess it seems like the focus for Iber has been earlier upfront and maintenance, and Mezi a little bit later. What do we know about Mezi after prior anti-CD38 therapy, Paul?
Very active. I mean, triple class refractory disease. We saw in our Mezi-Dex simple oral combination study, we saw a very respectable response rate of 41%. What really caught my attention was that actually, if you looked at the patients who are BCMA refractory, the response rate moved up to 50%, which is kind of very interesting, because with iberdomide, we saw a similar signal that somehow post-BCMA exposed patients, the response rates were marginally higher. The other thing that was interesting as well was, frankly, in the Mezi experience, this impact on extramedullary disease. And that's so important, because EMD is such a barrier to successful outcome in these heavily pretreated patients.
And we were actually going to talk about next EMD. And I'm just kind of curious. First of all, Natalie, can you talk a little bit about clinically where you see what locations, and when you have extramedullary disease, where it is, what kind of symptoms it causes? And also something that I was chatting with Paul about last week, with the CNS involvement with myeloma.
Right. Well, I think there's a percentage of patients who present at diagnosis with extramedullary disease, and frankly, it can show up almost anywhere. You can have soft tissue masses. I'm sure we can go down the list of seeing them pretty much everywhere. I've seen them in the prostate, for example, in the the lungs, the sinuses. Those are probably pretty common. But soft tissue anywhere you can think of, and again, the incidence of starting to see EMD really grows as patients become more refractory. And I think we're more sensitized to this because imaging is so much better than it used to be. Now we're much more aware. And so you do have to be quite suspicious sometimes if people come in with a lump. You know, it's not necessarily a lipoma. It might be some EMD. I've actually gotten picked up a few people now who come in with what looks like a sinus infection, but it's a plasmacytoma that's growing in the maxillary sinus. So you really, I think, have to be sensitized that these can show up almost anywhere.
Paul, anything you would add to that? What about CNS involvement? Where do you see it? How does it present? And have you seen useful responses with CELMoDs or MESI?
Well, great question. Obviously, CNS involvement's been an exclusion for participation in the current clinical trial. So I think it's early days for the CELMoD construct there, but I would expect it to be active, remembering that pomalidomide is active in the central nervous system. I think very importantly, though, as we've gotten better with our quadruplet therapies up front, we're seeing more unusual extramedullary disease emerge post quad therapy, and especially after quad therapies run out of steam. We also see a pattern of extramedullary disease emerging after immunotherapies have also failed a patient, be it CAR T or bispecific. And I so agree with Natalie that the spectrum of EMD is fascinating, and I 100% agree about the sinuses, the aerodigestive tract, the skin, soft tissue. I just have a patient recently who presented with an 8-centimeter mass in his thigh, and it turned out to be EMD when the rest of his disease had responded beautifully to quadruplet therapy, but he had this isolated spot that just emerged, and he thought it was just a muscle pull. Imaging, bingo, 8-centimeter extramedullary disease in his thigh. So just be really thoughtful about this, because I think there are lots of factors at play. But my sense of activity in EMD is very impressive for mezigdomide. It was specifically designed to do this. The molecular structure was done in a way to optimize tissue penetration. And it's probably, in my experience, and I'd love Natalie's thoughts on this, I think it's probably the most active oral agent against EMD that I've ever used.
I think that's right. I just wanted to add a couple other things to Paul's comments about EMD. Particularly, we're very used to seeing this when you treat a lot of myeloma patients, particularly those who've been around living, fortunately, for so much longer. But this whole presentation now of people who have no change in their monoclonal protein, no light chain elevation, but they are walking in the door with a new extramedullary deposit. I'm sure you've seen that, Paul, many, many times. I know that I have, and you just have to be super suspicious about any sort of new symptoms, I think.
Yeah, and the good news
speculation?
Is you could. Sorry.
I was going to say. No, tell us the good news first.
I was just going to say to give help to community guys. I mean, obviously, this sounds scary, but they can be highly radio sensitive, and obviously, we've got a number of drugs we can use to engage it. So I don't want our audience to be scared that EMD. Oh my God, it's the sword of Damocles. No, but it is a challenge.
Natalie, any speculations about why some people get EMD and others don't, what the mechanisms are, or even any risk factors for EMD?
Cytogenetically, higher risk patients tend to be those who have more of a risk of EMD. And I think we're still not understanding all of this completely. There have been some very interesting studies where different biopsy sites, different tumor sites have been biopsied, and there's clearly a difference in their, molecular mutations, things like that. One speculation is as patients seem to be secreting less protein, the cells are spending more time on their proliferation and spending less time with protein synthesis. But I definitely think the higher risk patients tend to continue to have that risk as they go through their years of life with their myeloma. You always have to think about that.
Yeah, and I'd love to add to this, if I may, Neil, because I think you're touching on a very interesting point. EMD early in the myeloma course is different to EMD later, and we have clinical trials that show that. I mean, we have, for example, EMD later, there's more stemness to the disease. You can see it after BCMA therapy has unfortunately failed the patient. It's almost as if there's a stemness escape. And in this setting, I really do believe there's value to cytotoxic chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we no longer have it immediately available in the US, but it's fully approved ex-US. Melflufen was particularly active in this group of patients. Just to remind people, that was a melphalan warhead leveraged within a special construct to deliver it into the jaws of the tumor. And I'm hopeful that we'll see, you know, further work in that space to bring that forward, because EMD late is a big challenge, isn't it, Natalie? I mean, we really do face a different monster late than we do early.
So why don't we just take a quick breath? I see a case in the chat room. Okay. Natalie, let's start with you, see what your thoughts are. This is from Dr. Rudolph. Newly diagnosed IgA myeloma with EMD with cord compression at L1. Okay. Complex cytogenetics, myeloma FISH and DEL with a DEL1Q, MYC rearrangement, trisomy 9, multiple other bone lesions, normal renal function, hemoglobin of 12. This patient is 69 years old. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about what to do, Natalie?
Well, I think, you know, first off, usually if there is a threat of a cord compression, that needs to be addressed. And one of the nice things about most of the agents in a quadruplet regimen, you can do simultaneous treatment as well as radiation and start off with that. So certainly, I would be, after a quadruplet induction, I would be sending this patient towards a transplant. I think that would be pretty, pretty standard. What starts to get a little bit more controversial talking to various colleagues is what you do after the transplant. So, you know, right now a lot of people are using lenalidomide and daratumumab is kind of the standard, but there are some individuals who would think a quadruplet maintenance would even be indicated in a person who looks so high risk. And, you know, MYC is not a good thing to have. Mm-hmm. It's not included in our IMWG high risk, but I think we're pretty confident that that usually signals a more active myeloma.
So, Paul, as we were talking, Dr. Rudolph typed in also that the patient right now is getting radiation therapy, but she says, what quad regimen would you use? Or would you want to use carfilzomib? And getting back to what we were saying about CD38, any preference there, Paul?
Great question. I think if one's thinking about the one of the things to recognize about both cytotoxic chemotherapy and XRT is they're immunogenic. They generate an immunogenic signal that we can then leverage. So I think quad makes great sense. I think if prior bortezomib has either failed the patient or it's not appropriate, I like the idea of carfilzomib in this higher risk patient. I also like the idea of isatuximab for the reasons we talked about earlier. And in terms of the IMID platforms, I do agree with Natalie. Current IMID platforms, in my experience, are not wonderful against EMD. They're not. They're not. Pomalidomide probably better than Len, but at the end of the day, this is perhaps where the CELMoDs have really a leg up, in particular Mezi, probably a little more so than Iber, in fact. So in that context, that sort of optimized quad could be deployed in that setting. I wanted to build on a point that Natalie made, which I think is really interesting. I do agree with her about the role of transplant in these higher risk patients. And obviously an exciting thing to see is where will CAR-T land? You know, what will CAR-T do for us in that setting? And could we be thinking even of sequencing with all the caveats of toxicities, strategies in these ultra high risk patients? So we'll have to see what the research tells us as it comes out.
I mean, Natalie, what would you expect the effects would be of a quad with a radiation therapy in a patient like that? Do you think that a transplant would be adequate? Do you think that theoretically CAR-T would be better or somehow both?
Well, I think for this kind of patient, what we tend to do is try to not take the foot off the gas, so to speak, and so that, you know, post-transplant, we would be certainly using at least a triplet. And I, you know, with what's available commercially, this is a person we tend to use POM for, and usually an anti-CD38 as well. And then this is the kind of patient where we have been checking MRD, looking for loss. You know, it's usually fairly straightforward to get these patients MRD negative early on, but what we're really looking for is people who are escaping quickly and then coming in with, you know, CAR-T, as Paul mentioned, but being very mindful that these patients have a very quick tendency to relapse.
Yeah. It's a great point. And just one other caveat here, Neil, there's this entity of clonal escape. And the other thing to remember is the construct of a sanctuary site, right? Mm. So it's a little bit nuanced. So in other words, if you've got an obvious sanctuary site and you've got beautiful response everywhere else, disrupting that sanctuary site and maximizing your systemic therapy to improve drug delivery is a reasonable strategy. Mm-hmm. And just always remembering for our audience, intravenous bortezomib in EMD settings is far more efficacious than sub-Q because you get that Cmax effect that you need. I like carfilzomib too in the EMD setting for high-risk reasons, but if you're stuck, you know, you've got an older patient who's frail with a cardiac history and you need to get that proteasome inhibitor in, don't forget IV proteasome inhibition with bortezomib because it is superior to sub-Q in the EMD setting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, as we move towards where the CELMoDs are going to be heading, the tolerability, which kind of sounds like has driven a lot of the strategy about how, why, where, what setting these agents are being looked at. And again, I'm just going to flip through a bunch of slides. You want to go back and look at the numbers. I can tell you there are a lot of zeros in there in terms of tolerability issues. But Natalie, maybe you can start out with just sort of a broad overview of the tolerability side effects issues that you see with these two agents and kind of what the difference is. It seems like Mezi causes a little bit more of an issue, maybe a little bit more effective. What's your take on that, Natalie?
Well, I think one of the, specifically looking at the Rekindle study, I was very impressed that the side effect profile is no different than, say, the endurance trial looking at VRD that was done years ago in terms of the grade 3-4 effects. You do have to be a little bit mindful of what carfilzomib is bringing to the table in terms of side effects. But I think that looking at the kind of benefit you get from the addition of Mezi here is just really amazing. So,
Paul, can you talk more specifically about the issues that are seen, particularly cytopenias, fatigue, and other complications, and how would you compare the two in terms of what's seen?
Well, I think a couple of interesting points. The non-hematologic side effects are really gratifyingly low. GI side effects in particular, and also neuropathy, we just simply don't see it. You do sometimes see with mezigdomide fatigue, and I have seen a few isolated cases of dysgeusia, but again, very manageable, in contrast sometimes to what we see, for example, with talquetamab, where it can be much more difficult. I think in the same token, neutropenia is essential to get ahead of, and I must, you know, when we, God willing, you know, folks on the call will be using mezigdomide in the near future, stay ahead of it with GCSF. It's very important to use growth factor. It's important to understand that you're not doing any harm to the stem cells either. It's a different mechanism. You basically keep that GCSF on board, keep those counts up, and be vigilant. And one of the good things we saw in our trial so far is the rates of febrile neutropenia are actually quite low. In fact, very low, given the degrees of neutropenia we see. So we're kind of encouraged by that. And I think the other side effect that we've seen is thrombocytopenia, but again, manageable. And I've seen minimal to practically no bleeding. So again, manageable side effect profile for Mezi for sure.
So Natalie, Paul referred to the potential FDA approval of these two agents. I kind of figured they already would have been approved by now. I feel like we've been hearing about this for a while. They've been sounding really good for a while. Any thoughts, Natalie, about FDA approval? Do you see that in the near future?
Well, the rumor is that IBER may be approved this year. I think at least that's the rumor that I've heard. I don't think Mezi would be, but I think it's soon to follow. I don't know, Paul, if you've got more insight than I do about that.
Well, I think the important point is there is a press release around Excalibur, which is the iberdomide study, to say it's met its primary endpoint of MRD improvement. And obviously, they're not reporting that outcome yet until they've got the PFS data and others to match it. I will tell you that actually the good news around Mezi is that, and I give enormous credit to the sponsor here, there was a very organized approach to Successor 1 and 2 with a dose optimization strategy in phase 1 of the study, and then phase 2 was the classic randomized phase 3. We worked very hard with the FDA and worked our way through this because your point's well taken, Neil. Many of us thought there was a platform for FDA accelerated approval for Mezi some years ago, especially given the oral bioavailability. And in fairness, there were lots of, you know, complications in that space at the time, not least of which, you know, the pandemic and everything we were dealing with. But that being said, now Successor 2, for example, I think is really nicely positioned with Successor 1 right behind it. To echo Natalie's point, Mezzi's approval, I personally feel, is coming much closer. Exactly where it is, I don't know. But I will share with you that the design of the studies, I think, has been carefully worked out with FDA. I think they have been very happy with the way we've dose optimized. And I think it's going to bring to the community a very well worked out dose and schedule that will make it a little, perhaps unlike our old days, right, Natalie, of myeloma therapy, where you could do a bit of this and a bit of that and everybody kind of played around. The CELMoD space will be a little bit more organized, and we'll be able to tell our providers exactly what they need to do in terms of dose and schedule.
So, Natalie, we just saw this press release come out from the FDA, FDA about minimal residual disease and complete response in myeloma. You know, also in solid tumors, we have, you know, cell-free DNA, MRD assays like Signatera that are being looked at. I was mentioning this paper in bladder cancer. I think it's the first solid tumor trial where it actually was integrated into the design of the study, and it showed that it actually worked. And, you know, they were interested when this thing came out from the FDA, but this was just about myeloma. Can you talk a little bit about the meaning of this? And we're going to get into the Excalibur study in a second. But what were your thoughts about this FDA statement?
Well, I think one of the amazing things about working in myeloma for a number of years is that we used to have a paradigm that we were trying so hard to make your first treatment the best because we really didn't have much to do afterwards. The follow-up treatments were not great. But these drugs are just going to change everything. I mean, the fact that you can get a person back in remission, MRD negative, in the relapse setting is just astounding. And I think that we're going to be seeing more and more. That has to be the new bar for any sort of relapse treatment, that it's got to be that good. So I think this is just so exciting. And obviously we saw, Dara and teclistamab data here at ASH. I mean, but these strategies are just amazing that they are available for patients, particularly the Iberg Excalibur data coming out so soon.
Yeah, I would echo that, Neil. I think one of the most important things to share with the audience, though, is we truly need all hands to the pumps, right? You know, what's right for a patient to receive a magnetism 3-type regimen for a selected patient is great, obviously. That's not for everyone, right? The infection signal in that combination was very real. And the beautiful thing, I think, about the CELMoDs is they bring a every man, every woman sort of a dimension to them, that they're going to be able to be used for everyone, particularly communities of exquisite unmet medical need, because it's truly oral, it's truly off the shelf, and something you could deliver in a community practice in the Midwest, as well as, you know, suburban areas, you know, which all also benefit from it equally well.
And we're just showing here a paper from last summer in the New England Journal that Paul actually has part of the editorial on talking about MRD, so you can check that out. But where it seems to be really relevant is this Excalibur study, where MRD is actually a primary endpoint. Paul, can you talk about what the study is looking at? And we don't have the data yet, but as often happens in oncology, we do have a press release saying that this is going to be a positive study. So what should we be looking at? What did this trial look at?
Well, basically, it was. I want to especially acknowledge my co-investigators and the leadership of Sagar in this trial. But it's been a privilege to be part of it. And Excalibur essentially was evaluating iberdomide combined with essentially daratumumab based therapy versus the active control, which was Dara VD. The dose optimization aspect of the style study was again very sort of resonant and harmonious with the Project Optimus requirements and guidelines from FDA. So stage one was dose optimization, then stage two was a randomized comparison of Dara VD compared to Iber Dara D. And the point is that it's a really ambitious design because it's head to head with Dara, obviously. It's head to head with a proteasome inhibitor. But the very good news is that the MRD primary endpoint was met, which suggests that there is a significant improvement in MRD clinically and actuarially. And that, obviously, we don't know those numbers. We will be blinded from those until we have PFS data and so forth. But at the end of the day, I think this bodes very well for an approval fairly soon, as Natalie suggested.
Natalie, any comments on this study? I'm not going to ask, as I was just flashing on, I wonder where Belamaf's going to fit in. When you're talking about comparing to Dara, since the DREAM study showed a benefit of of Blantumab. We won't get into that, but that's another player that's coming along pretty fast. Natalie, any thoughts about the Excalibur study?
Well, we had that available for patients here, and I think it's been very well tolerated. Again, I think, you know, we've heard, Paul and I have said this before, but Iber, in comparison to Len in particular, seems to have some real advantages for patients. And, you know, particularly to have a oral therapy that will be deliverable is going to be great. And I think we're all just holding our breath to see the actual results, but everybody's expecting them to be great.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think the important point, you asked the question about Bella. Bella, to my mind, is an excellent choice when you need to pick a BCMA-targeting approach, and in particular for patients in whom a powerful immunotherapeutic platform like cilta-cel may not be appropriate, and even a bispecific with its attendant infectious risk may be more difficult. The point is, I frankly use all of them. And what I think so interesting is that Bella is not immune-exhausting. That data has clearly become apparent, and that's really important. So it's very interesting, Neil. I'd love our audience to not think it's one versus the other. We need all of them. And I think that's a critically important point. There is also great data emerging now with Iberbella. And for that matter, there's going to be data on Mezibella. There's an alliance trial, which is a privilege to be part of and enroll patients to it, where we're giving Bella Dex plus minus Iber. There's a lovely crossover piece in it, which I think is a very patient-friendly approach. It's led by my colleague Monique Hartley-Brown and Yvonne Efebera from Ohio State. And the fact is that you've got platforms like this, which I think will give real options to patients. So they mustn't feel, you know, they've either got to get the Cadillac of a CAR T or a, you know, the Mercedes of a bispecific. You can actually get, you know, something that's going to work for you where you are and be truly off the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, Bella Iber D sounds very well tolerated. How about where Mezi's heading, Paul? We have the Successor 1 and 2 studies. What are they looking at?
Well, the Successor 1 and 2, it's again been a privilege to be part of this with great investigators and a great sponsor. I think the important point about them is that these are designed for real-world practice when you translate, right? So you've got basically Mezi-VD as your experimental arm compared to Pom-Veldex, which is your control arm in Successor 1. Again, with this very well done stage one, which is this dose optimization. And then pivoting across to Successor 2, this has been a wonderful study. It's actually led by my colleague Thanos Dimopoulos. It's been, again, a privilege to be part of it. But the bottom line is that we've been comparing KD as a control arm, which itself is actually so active that it's a reasonable control arm. Although I have to say, you know, I think that's going to evolve quickly over time. But Mezi-KD, and that's the experimental arm. And in Successor 2, we've been really pleased with how the triplet has performed. Actually, funny enough, Dana-Farber were the lead, were the global lead enroller to that trial, funny enough. And I'm very proud of that because Rick Pazda said to me, where's the US involvement? And I was hoping to be able to say that directly to him at some point. But the bottom line is, you know, we've been a lead enroller to that study internationally, and we've been very pleased with the performance of Mezi-KD.
So, Natalie, any comments on this presentation from ASH looking at Iber maintenance after transplant? This is a phase 2 study, the EMN26 trial. Any thoughts about this and how these data indirectly compare to what we've seen with lenalidomide maintenance?
Well, I think one of the, you know, tolerability, we've said this over and over again about Iber, I think that looks great. And the fact that they continue to show conversions in terms of response over time, we know that there's sort of a plateau in the lenalidomide response post-transplant, beyond which, you know, it's in the Stamina trial about 18 months afterwards, you didn't see any more conversions. But I think we're all waiting to see what the head-to-head trial of lenalidomide versus Iber in the post-transplant setting, how that pans out. But at least this preliminary from EM26 looks like it's probably going to win, is my guess.
Paul?
Yeah, I completely agree with Natalie. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at Iber, you've got an up to 72% response improvement by cycle 12. At the same time, much as I love Len, it clocks in at 31%. Right. Now, we have to be careful, but that suggests it's very consistent with what we've seen. Just to remind the audience, you know, basically in the early trials of both Iber and Mezi, you had to be Len refractory. So all the response rates we're quoting to you are in Len refractory patients. So this makes sense. It makes sense that you're going to see a more potent effect from your oral agent in this setting.
So, Natalie, we're going to talk in a second about determination too, but Can you comment a little bit first on where you see the most likely combinations of being successful? What are some of the ongoing trials looking at these two agents you're most looking forward to see? And where do you think we're going to land 2 or 3 years from now with these agents, CELMoDs?
Well, I think we have so many great combinations to take a look at. I think the T-cell redirecting arena is very interesting and very exciting. I think we all, those of us who've used bispecifics, are really looking for ways to limit. We get that great response, but we know that the longer the patients are on it, they can get sort of accumulated toxicity. Mm. And I'm hopeful that the inclusion of CELMoDs like this will help us to sort of taper off the bispecific component and keep those together. And then, of course, we know that, unfortunately, people do relapse after CAR T. And if we could figure out how to maintain that response and if the CELMoDs help us do that, that's going to be great. And I think, there's just so many potential uses here. It's hard to sort of pick your favorite. But I think to Paul's point here, the other thing I'd like to say about belantamab is that it has this wonderful capability of being used in almost any clinical setting. It's so easy to give people. There's so little side effect in terms of the infusion. If we're giving it now quarterly and combining it with a CELMoD, that may be that like one of the best combinations we have, particularly in places where it's hard to get to a clinic. I think that may be great.
I so agree with you, Anathy. I have a patient who, basically she's got really significant pulmonary disease that's got nothing to do with her myeloma, puts her at constant risk of overwhelming infections in her lungs. Mm-hmm. She's a young person, and basically on the combination of belantamab with POM in her case, but obviously in the future she would be perfect for Iber or Mezi. She's had the best response she's ever had in her 10-year journey to Bella POM, and she's had not a single chest infection. She goes to, in Denver, it's in the Colorado Jewish, the pulmonary center there, because she literally has chronic aspergillus in her lungs. Mm-hmm. Now, I could never, ever in my right mind have given her a bispecific. Right. And I would honestly, if we'd taken her to CAR T, she wouldn't have survived. Right. And she's a lovely, vibrant lady, not too far from you, actually, as it happens, Neil. And the fact of the matter is, she was just telling me, had one of the greatest holiday seasons she's had. And that's on Bellapom.
Awesome. So again, before we get into determination, just to come back to you, Natalie, kind of a basic question I've kind of been thinking about for a while in terms of, when we think back about the mechanisms of how these CELMoDs work, why is it specific to myeloma? Can you talk a little bit more about your vision about why this pathway or this mechanism is tied into myeloma specifically?
Well, I think it may have something to do with what the actual function of plasma cells are in general. And they are production centers for proteins, and that's really what they're supposed to do. And I think that may make them particularly sensitive to mechanisms that are sort of shutting down that kind of proliferation. At least that's my guess.
So let's move on now. I want to talk about determination two. It's going to be a really interesting and important study, but also I think relevant to our topic here today. Paul, can you kind of summarize a little bit about what determination one or the determination trial showed, and then the sort of the follow-up that you presented at the ASH meeting?
Yeah, thank you, Neil. Well, first and foremost, in D1, we were able to show there was this really impressive PFS gain for early transplant, which exceeded our expectations. The challenge was that we didn't see an overall survival difference emerge with relatively mature follow-up, although we've got more follow-up coming very soon, which I think will be very helpful in further establishing one way or another this OS signal. But what was really interesting in our overall survival was that actually only 28% of the delayed transplant arm at the time of this analysis had delayed transplant. 72% had other things. And I guess the point was, it was clearly showing that transplant remains a standard of care. That's not the question. The question is there competing risk, and are there subsets of patients who may get more out of early transplant and subsets who may get more out of delaying it or deferring it? And I think that's the key message from determination one. And obviously now, with the success of quadruplet therapies, we can even be more tailored in our choices versus using high-dose melphalan early or keeping it in reserve. And I think one of the most important things that we identified in determination one were the subgroups who didn't seem to get as much benefit from early transplant as the majority of the study population. And one of the most striking findings was that we saw in our African-American population, or in those patients who identified as being black, that they actually did got they got benefit from transplant. It wasn't that they were hurt by transplant, but they got that much more benefit from the RVD alone and keeping transplant in reserve. That struck us. And so what we then did was took a deeper dive to understand that. And I want to especially acknowledge my colleague, Lauren Mers, who's been a leader in the Duffy-Null field. We had the privilege of her being a fellow with us originally. She's now an attending physician and co-investigator on Determination 2 now at the University of Michigan with the Michigan team. And Lauren has done really fabulous work with Duffy-Null. And when she came to us, she said, look, Paul, can we look at your leukopenias and see if, you know, this leukopenia was contributing to the difference that you were seeing between African Americans and Caucasians? And oddly enough, it wasn't. It wasn't the leukopenia that was the issue. So we then sat down and I sort of began to understand more about what Duffy is. And when I understood that actually it's a phenotype in the red cell that actually hardens the red cell, which to you and I, if we're Duffy non-null, gives us an ability to absorb inflammation, chemokine stress, and cytokine stress. Obviously, the reason it was such an evolutionary advantage to people who are Duffy null, both in the Africa and the Middle East, was because it conveyed survival advantage in the face of malaria, specifically Plasmodium vivax. The trouble is, in modern society, it means you're much more vulnerable to inflammatory stress. Now, we know that inflammation is basically the caviar to myeloma. We also know that in treatment, if you exacerbate inflammation, outcomes can be worse. So we have this working hypothesis that in patients who are Duffy null, reducing inflammatory stress, minimizing chemokine and cytokine disturbance may actually have an advantage. And I think what's so interesting is there's lovely work by Gareth Morgan and colleagues from New York University and other centers where the inflammasome impacts on gene expression in myeloma. And fascinatingly, gene expression to adverse signatures like ACPA-BEC can be enhanced by increased inflammation. Isn't that interesting? That's a hypothesis that's kind of working its way through, but it starts to make sense of all of this. And it sort of suggests to you that if you're Duffy null, sure, you can get benefit from triplet and quad therapy. Be careful how you use your more intensive pro-inflammatory platforms, recognizing that we have no suggestion in determination that transplant hurt Duffy null patients. It was just that the non-transplant arm did that much better than we expected.
So can you, you know, when I think of Duffy null, I think of leukopenia, you know, I'm not sure I get too far beyond that. Maybe Natalie, you can take it. Here's a kind of a cool diagram. And you talk a little bit more about kind of what it functionally does. And I mean, when you talk about inflammatory treatments, I guess you're talking about chemo and transplant. So how do you tie in the fact that they didn't seem to benefit as much from really chemo, high-dose chemo, and the Duffy null status?
Well, I think as Paul was talking about, the response to particularly to agents that are producing a lot of inflammation. So if you take your sort of standard alkylating agent, you are having a lot of DNA damage, and that just may not be the right approach in an individual who is Duffy null. I think I think we're really at a very early stage of understanding.
Yeah,
I think Paul would say in terms of what are all the features that being Duffy null brings to bear on your selection of treatments? And I think we're still struggling with, are we at the point that you could potentially pick differently for patients based on this one feature? I don't know that we're there yet.
No.
And I think that one of the biggest struggles, I think we're trying to get people, and Paul's work has been so critical about this, is just getting people to even think about it and trying to make sure our trials take this into account. I would say probably it's a minority of patients who are even being tested for this at this point.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, Natalie. Sorry, what I was going to say, Neil, is that we're testing everyone now for Duffy null because one thing we found is people identify as being African in heritage. Oddly enough, there are many people who don't identify but have African heritage or Middle Eastern heritage. And if you in the Middle East, it's actually surprising in certain areas, Duffy null is present in frequencies up to 90%. And so if that's the case, looking for Duffy null has implications for leukopenia anyway. But I think Natalie's absolutely right. It's important to recognize our work right now is hypothesis generating. D2 is going to drill down much harder on this to really figure it out. But I think it's very important to share this only because I think that there's a signal here, particularly given that Duffy null is present in 70% of people of African American heritage. It's also, to my mind, a clue as to perhaps why in African Americans, myeloma is more common because essentially they can't handle inflammation. And if they can't handle inflammation, we all know, how do you goose your myeloma? You inflame the patient. So, you know, without getting ahead of myself, I just think there's some really interesting work to follow here. But I agree with Natalie 100%. If I thought there was an African American patient who was Duffy null, who was, say, 414 positive, wasn't responding well to their quad, I wouldn't hesitate to say, look, please think seriously about a transplant. Conversely, though, if they were 414 positive, they had a beautiful response to quad, and maybe one wanted to think, you know, and they wanted to be careful because, you know, they had some family history or CHIP mutations that make them a bit more vulnerable to some of the downsides of high-dose melphalan, you might reasonably say, well, you know what, maybe we'll keep that in reserve and think a bit more about it. But I think we have to be very careful not to get ahead of ourselves, as Natalie pointed it out.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually what I was about to say, because, you know, when I first saw the determination study originally, I was thinking, oh, there's going to be a lot less transplant, and then no. And then I was thinking, well, maybe people would be less likely to offer transplant to an African-American patient, and I didn't hear too much excitement about that. But I'm just going to say right now, for practical purposes, I mean, even just to start, if you have a patient, as you said, who has a great response, maybe they're MRD positive from a quad, they're African American, or just if they're Duffy null. I mean, look, here you see the Duffy non-null patients, African American Duffy non-null. But what's really interesting is when you look at Duffy null patients, and specifically also, as Paul was just talking about, African American Duffy null patients, they did better with RVD alone. So, you know, Natalie, you've got an African-American patient who's Duffy null. Would you say, hey, I'm not really sure that transplant's going to benefit you, or you don't say because
well,
we need more data?
I do think we have to have a little modicum of caution because there was an important retrospective study that came out a few years ago looking at patients through the VA system, black versus white, who were going through treatments, transplant, and black patients actually had better survival. And the difference really seemed to be access to care, access to everything that you might have. And so I think you have to figure out a way to explain all of this and not just assume that. I mean, I think this has been the story of myeloma, assuming that we know everything there is to know. That's obviously something that we continually are humbled every day that there's more and more. So I think this is just fascinating data that Paul and his group has brought to us. And I think we just are trying to figure out how to understand it better.
Yeah, Neil, I completely agree with Natalie. I think it's hypothesis generating, but I think what struck us is that flip of those curves. And I just want to be
absolutely
very careful, because
yeah,
the important point that Lauren defended very well at ASH was, you know, the statisticians in the audience said, well, hang on a second, let's look at that very hard. And Susanna Jacobus is our statistician. She's fabulous. Mm-hmm. She's at ECOG, and
absolutely,
Natalie knows her well.
Mm-hmm.
And these are statistically meaningful differences. The numbers are small, so we have to be careful. But I also think they're meaningful in the sense that we are seeing the confidence intervals, we're seeing the hazard ratios, and we're seeing the p-values. So I think there's a signal here that we need to better understand. And I fully agree with Natalie. Access to care is critical. But I think the good news is that that is changing all for the better for everyone. And so, therefore, we can now start to tailor choices for each of our patients. And obviously, if we get a sense that certain treatments may be better for certain patients versus others, you know, more power to it.
So thank you so much, Natalie and Paul. It's been great, as always, to work with you. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so
thank
much,
you.
Natalie. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for the
have
opportunity.
A good one.